Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks, Nathan. Glad you're with us this morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, a conversation with the author James Magruder. He'll be reading from his new book of stories tomorrow night at the Ivy Bookshop. But first, I want to let you know about an announcement that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake made yesterday concerning city funding for arts organizations and individual artists. For years, the city budget included money to support the operating expenses of large and mid-sized organizations. Museums and theaters, performing organizations, could always count on at least modest support from the city. Well, that all ended in 2010, when the city faced severe financial challenges and the arts were removed from the budget for all but a few large institutions. Well, yesterday, Mayor Rawlings-Blake announced that the Creative Baltimore Fund was being reinstated and that 34 organizations will receive grants that range from $3,500 to $10,000 to fund their programs. Recipients include Center Stage and the Everyman Theater, Baltimore Clayworks, the Maryland Historical Society, the Maryland Humanities Council, and the City Lit Project. Now, full disclosure, the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, of which I'm the music director, will also receive a Creative Baltimore Fund grant this year. In addition, five individual artist grants of $5,000 each were announced for Amanda Burnham, Peter Brune, Tamara Payne, Alana Purdy, and John Spellman. In all, the city will grant about $250,000 through the Creative Baltimore Fund. Now, as you can imagine, this news was greeted with great enthusiasm from the arts sector. Many local arts leaders saw the exclusion of arts organizations from the city budget as inconsistent with the goal of making Baltimore a more livable place and at cross-purposes with the mayor's goal of attracting 10,000 new residents to the city. At yesterday's announcement, Kwame Kwe-Arma of Center Stage noted that these grants were important because they fund general operating expenses. Many foundations and corporations who support the arts do so only for specific projects or performances, and arts organizations often find it difficult to find support for their infrastructure and staff. The mayor told me yesterday that before reintroducing the Creative Baltimore Fund to the budget, it was important to her that it was able to be sustained. So she plans for arts grants to be part of the city budget for the foreseeable future. We'll have a complete list of recipients on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now we turn to the Baltimore-based author James Magruder. He's just published a new collection of interrelated short stories called Let Me See It. It's about family, it's about coming of age, it's about coming out, it's about the complexities and challenges that we all face at different times in our lives. James Magruder is the former dramaturg at Center Stage. He's an award-winning translator, a playwright, and the author of a novel, Sugarless. And Jim Magruder, that was the book we talked about last time you were here, and welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back, Tom.
So early in the book, in the second story, we're introduced to a little kid named Elliot Bidler. He's 11 years old. It's 1971. Tell us a little bit about Elliot and then what we learn about Elliot as the book proceeds.
Well, Elliot is, this is a very autobiographical collection, as was Sugarless. Elliot is, he's 11 and he wants to please and he wants to score very, very well at whatever he does. And his parents are splitting up. And in that particular story, he's called upon to do a fifth grade social studies project. And he and a neighbor boy build a sugar cube pyramid of Tenochtitlan. And complications ensue. And as he grows older, he graduates in the recession, the Reagan recession of the early 80s, as did I, which was the worst recession before this last one. And he's just completely at sea about what to do with his life. And as he goes on, he has affairs with older men that are sort of mysterious to him. And by the end, he's not doing so well. He's dying of AIDS in Paris. I've just given away. Well, I haven't given away the whole book. He doesn't die. Well, no, now I really have given away the book. Anyway.
And later on, just a story or two later after the first one, we are introduced to Tom Emilio. At that point, he's 18 years old. He's Elliot's cousin. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about Tom.
Tom has, unlike Elliot has, I would say, a white-collar dad. An accountant, and Tom has a butcher for a father, blue collar, and they're related. Tom's mother is the sister to Elliot's father, but they almost never see each other. Elliot's family hopscotches around the country, and Tom stays put in Kansas City. And so he has different expectations as a gay man growing up, son of working class, without one of those, what is it, the dads who can help you invest in. That was just a few years ago about, like, you know, a smart dad or a bad dad. That's about investing money. Anyway, so
there are certainly plenty of both of those.
Right. So Tom is much more doesn't follow his doesn't follows his head more than his heart. And so as he and his cousin never really meet until they're 25 and they're both in New York for one summer, Elliot convinces Tom to come to New York. And then their differences are made plain by their responses to the AIDS crisis.
Now, you mentioned this is autobiographical. Mm-hmm. Marion Winnick, our dear mutual friend who's hosting the event at the Ivy tomorrow night, says that you've basically split the autobiography of yourself through these two characters. Is that accurate?
I'd say it's accurate. I think reading it all together and thinking about it, I realized that Elliot is the me who should have died in Paris in 1991 because I have had the HIV virus since 1985 but I've had a clean bill of health, zero viral load since 1996. And part of me in the 80s, people were acting up and everyone was dying. I was in grad school in New Haven and I have survivor's guilt because I didn't march. I didn't help 55 people die. I wasn't taking to the streets. I had the virus, but I was studying French literature and dramaturgy. And I'm just kind of guilty. I mean, I understand survivor's guilt. And so when I was given sort of the chance or given the second lease on life around 1996, that's what actually when I downsized myself at Center Stage and Triumph of Love went to Broadway. And then I thought, well, really, if I've been given this extra time.
That's the piece that you wrote for Broadway. Mm-hmm.
What should I do with the time that's left? And I thought, well, I need to write. I need to fulfill, quote unquote, my early promise, whatever that meant.
Early, middle, late promise.
Late bloomer.
If you got some promise, grab it, whatever period it comes from. Because you do write, this period, the book covers the period from early 1970s to the beginning of the 1980s. He's right in the middle of the sort of the apex of this terrible crisis, the AIDS crisis. And it strikes me that there are two things about how we thought of this crisis back then and how we are thinking about them now. Two parameters that really affect how people approach this. One is the time difference. It was very different being a young gay man in the 1970s than it is being a young gay man now. And also the place difference. And you write about places that you have lived. Part of it's in Illinois, part of it's at Cornell where you went to, part of it's in Paris where you spent some time. You write about in these different places. It's a very different thing being a gay man in Greenwich Village in 2014 than in Wheaton, Illinois in 1975.
Right.
Yes. And so were these conscious, were you conscious of how people were reacting to, just the whole issue of the gay movement and in particular the AIDS crisis in all these different places?
I had to change some locations around to kind of make the cousins fit. But, New York in 1985, which is when the cousins get together, Elliot is kind of, he's not being an ostrich about it, but Tom is very, very aware there's something out called safe sex and one should adhere to it. But, I don't know if you saw The Normal Heart, which has just been on HBO this month.
I have not, but I hear great
things about it. I had somehow missed it in the 80s. Again, it might have been a self-protective gesture, but there were so many men in the 80s in New York who just didn't want, no, I'll die anyway. Nobody's going to tell me how to live my life or who to have sex with or how to have sex. And I remember at the time thinking safe sex seemed like the most ridiculous thing possible. And that's the subject of my next book, which I'm going to, once I finish reading, doing this little mini tour of Let Me See It, I'm going to try to find a publisher for.
On 881, it's Marilyn Morning. My guest is James Magruder. His latest book is called Let Me See It, A Collection of Stories. You're listening to Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. You and your partner, Steve, have just gotten back from a place that is perhaps one of the most inhospitable places for gay people on the planet. That's Uganda. We did a spotlight series, our Maryland Film Festival, WYPR spotlight series, with a fellow named Roger Ross Williams, a director who made a terrific movie called God Loves Uganda.
Great film.
And it's about, in part, American evangelicals who are going there and promoting strident anti-homosexual laws in Uganda. You were actually living there. Your partner, Steve, is a neuronatal nurse practitioner. You were doing studies. He was doing studies related to work at Hopkins. And you had to get out of there quick when the recent legislation passed. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, overnight, in mid-March, we got we were an openly gay couple living in Uganda, but again, we were Muzungus, or Europeans, that's their term, like for white people. Because we were a couple, and the real risk for us was that our servants could turn us in. We had a house girl who lived with us, and we had a cook twice a week, and if they didn't report that their employers were gay, they would get 5 years in prison. I mean, we always knew that it was going to be a little tricky there, but everyone kept saying, no, the president is never going to sign it, the president will never sign it, and then suddenly overnight he signed it.
And signed into law.
Signed it into law.
February.
Yeah. Yes. And it was no longer, you know, I mean, they downgraded it from death to life imprisonment now to 15 years in prison for what's known as aggravated homosexuality. So,
among other things, and it does, as you say, it requires citizens to inform police about mm-hmm. anyone they suspect is gay.
Yeah. And since then, I mean, in the last 10 days while we were packing up our two overweight cats in the household, things got dicey. The hotel clerks were calling the police when two men checked into a hotel together. There was an anti-pornography provision in that bill that meant that people were pulling women whom they deemed were wearing skirts that were inappropriate clothing, pulling them off their Boda Bodas, which are motorbikes, and stripping them publicly. And then a week after we left, there was a gigantic rally held on the president's airstrip with thousands of people and thousands of children, like waving flags like gays should die. And it was, you know,
But Hopkins made the decision.
Hopkins made this, at least in Steve's case, because we were a couple. Although, again, we were just so, this is the thing, is that Ugandans have no gaydar. It's the American fundamentalists who have lost all traction here in terms of this sort of issue. They go over there and they're sort of like, as you've seen God Loves Uganda, they're sort of nobody preachers, but figure they can go to Africa. And so like the legislation, the President Museveni's legislation actually has boilerplate from the fundamentalists' texts about, so they're just, it's crazy.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you made it back safe.
Yes,
I'm glad
too.
Your health is good, yeah. And I'm glad you've written this book. It's really a great read. Let me see it. So thanks so much, Jim Magruder. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Tom.
James Magruder, his new book is called Let Me See It. You can meet James Magruder tomorrow night at the Ivy Bookshop in Baltimore. Marion Winnick will host an event with James and Clifford Chase. It starts at 7 o'clock, and next Tuesday, Mr. Magruder will be reading from Let Me See It at the Barnes & Noble bookstore in Charles Village. That event also starts at 7 o'clock. That's it for us today. Friday morning, a conversation about Howard County's efforts to expand mental health services and a visit from the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. I hope you can join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers and provides me with invaluable fashion advice. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's his fault. We have production help also from Brandon Block, Alexander Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.